Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning, January 13th. Currently 10 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. We've got 11 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Wasatch back. Yeah, beautiful start to your Monday. It's cold, of course. Frigid temperatures sticking around today into tomorrow before we start to see some warmer move back in. So 25 expected for the high today with a mix of sun and clouds this afternoon. Should see 7 degrees for the overnight low into Tuesday, 28 tomorrow for the high, sunny. High pressure builds in midweek, should allow for some warming. In fact, we'll still see those temperatures overnight near 10 degrees by midweek, but 35 for the high, so back above freezing by Wednesday and a high of 40 on Thursday. Changes are ahead of another storm system that's moving in for this weekend. We'll see temperatures fall some on Friday to 34 and then just in the 20s for highs this weekend. Chances of snow increasing late Friday with a chance of snow on Saturday. Not a big storm system. We'll keep our eyes on it, but hey, we'll take whatever snow we can get into the weekend. And temperatures return to single digits for overnight lows this weekend in Park City as well. Heber today, 28, partly cloudy skies, 5 degrees for the overnight low into Tuesday, 31 tomorrow to 37 on Wednesday, back in the low 40s on Thursday with sunshine throughout this week. We'll start to see valley inversions set back up as high pressure will be in place through at least Thursday. Changes arriving Friday, especially Friday evening. We drop to 38 for the high. Plan on snow showers Friday night into Saturday. Temperatures in the 20s this weekend for Heber Valley as well. Overnight lows back into the single digits.
Okay, Nate, thank you.
You bet.
And taking a look now at the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, we've got Dave on the line. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great, Dave. Looks like you've backed off of the considerable danger.
You know, we did. It was a lot of conversation amongst all the forecasters and lots of conversations with our ski area operators and highway forecasters. And the snowpack itself is a pretty solid moderate danger. But we're still sticking to considerable travel advice, which means we're recommending that people use cautious route finding and conservative decision making while they're out there enjoying the most recent snow. Biggest factor that we're kind of looking at is the human factor. There's tons of great snow out there and lots of great snow surface for traveling. And people can find good soft travel on all aspects and elevation. It doesn't mean that we're done with this persistent weak layer. Even yesterday, the third skier on a slope in Butler Basin, which is just, you know, to the west of the Park City ridgeline, was able to trigger an avalanche that failed on that persistent weak layer. And so we are going to a moderate avalanche danger, but it's a pretty tentative moderate. And we're hoping that people will continue to travel cautiously, particularly with that layer in those thinner zones, sorry.
Okay. Dave, thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Stay tuned in just a few minutes. I'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Later on, Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher will be joined by Programs Director Heather Sims with an update on some of the youth sports programs. And Park City Education Foundation President and CEO Ingrid Whitley and Vice President of Advancement Jen Bello with an update on the preschool program. Taking a look at local news now, attorneys who filed a class action lawsuit against Vail Resorts say they are ready for a long procedural fight. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on what's next with the attempt to win damages for guests who skied Park City during the patrol strike.
The attorneys who sued Vail Resorts Thursday say anyone who had a pass or lift tickets and tried to ski during the strike can join the class action suit, but not quite yet. First, a judge must decide whether the class action lawsuit can proceed in a process called class certification. Attorney Daniel Tarpey expects it to be an arduous and long procedural fight. He and co-counsel have to prove there are enough skiers that may have been harmed in the same way during Park City Mountain's recent strike to justify class action.
At the end of the day, everyone faced the same exact thing, and that was that Vail misled them as to what the conditions were going to be there, what they were paying for, as of December 27th.
Following class certification, federal law requires a notice to go out to people who might qualify for compensation. After ski patrollers and mountain safety staff walked off the job during contract renegotiations asking for better pay and benefits, Park City Mountain's terrain was limited. Guests complained about long lines and others poached closed terrain. The lawsuit claims Vail is liable under Utah's consumer fraud law. Much like a CNBC commentator who weighed in about Vail's stock value, Tarpey skied Park City Mountain during the 13-day strike.
For the first time in my legal career, I watched a cause of action unfold in front of my eyes and had a personal experience with it. I recall I was riding single. I remember going up Silver Load. I waited for 58 minutes in the singles line. They had posted that the wait was 22 minutes.
Speaking on KPCW's Local News Hour January 10th, Tarpey expects Vail's attorneys to point to the waiver skiers sign when they purchase a pass. Park City Mountain's policies state lift tickets are usually non-refundable and guests forfeit the ability to sue. The policies explicitly forbid class action lawsuits, and if they do sue, quote, all lawsuits relating to or arising out of these terms will be brought in the federal or state courts located in Colorado. Tarpey and the other attorneys from Tarpey Wicks, Myers and Flowers, and the Spence Law Firm are suing in Utah.
We believe that a court here in Utah is going to step up and say we have the responsibility to protect the rights of those who come to Utah for an experience and don't get the experience that they're promised here in Utah.
The matter is on Judge David Barlow's desk in the state's U.S. District Court. Vail Resorts has yet to file a formal response and said it was unable to comment on pending litigation. After the strike ended January 8th, the company's Mountain Division president, Bill Rock, apologized to guests who were impacted by the strike and thanked employees who worked hard to keep the mountain open and operating safely over the past 2 weeks. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. So let's start with a health check. How are we doing with all of the winter viruses?
Yeah, we, just like Sundance is around the corner and ready to be in full swing, we are also in full swing with a variety of nasty little bugs that are making our lives a little bit miserable here as we start the new year, whether it's a stomach bug and norovirus or the typical seasonal respiratory issues that we see. It's definitely, there's an increase in the numbers, both in the wastewater numbers as well as just that anecdotal information of talking to those in our inner circles telling us that they're down and out for a few days.
Yeah. And what are you seeing most of? I mean, is it the flu? Is it COVID? Is it the RSV?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to say because, as we've talked about in the past, COVID-19 is reported differently than it was previously. Mm-hmm. It's not a reportable disease. There's home tests available, and a lot of times with the flu, unless someone is really ill, they're just kind of staying at home and seeing it through and hoping that they get better. So I think when it gets to be this time of year, I don't think individuals are as much concerned about what it is as much as it is just they're not feeling well. And that goes back to general social principles. If you're not feeling well, stay home, get lots of liquids, get some rest, let your body recover. And when you're feeling better and you're 24 hours past those major symptoms of fever, respiratory distress, a cough, 24 hours past that, you're probably good to go back to work and get back into the workspace. And then, as always, it's important to remember that there are those around you that might be immunocompromised. Their health is a little bit not on the best side that it could be. So let's be kind to those that are wearing masks, those that are protecting themselves, or even protecting those that they live with. It might also have some health conditions that we don't want to get them sick.
Okay, you mentioned norovirus. What's that?
Yeah, norovirus is one of those gastrointestinal foodborne illnesses that tends to pop up every now and then. It's probably not the first time that the listeners have heard that term because it's used quite a bit to describe really those typical GI or gastrointestinal symptoms that come with food poisoning, as it's commonly referred to. We see or hear about norovirus a lot in jails and prisons, cruise ships, dorms, schools, and it's a highly contagious virus that is transmitted fecal-oral transmission. So when we don't wash our hands well and we have individuals preparing food or they use the restroom and haven't washed their hands well and they find themselves grabbing a doorknob or a door handle, even a sink, And then we expose ourselves to that and then touch our hands to our mouth without washing them. Unfortunately, we get exposed to it as well. And being that it's as contagious as it is, it doesn't take much for someone to become sick with norovirus.
Yeah, so the symptoms, though, are very similar to food poisoning?
Yeah, most of the time when someone says they've been food poisoned, it's norovirus. And that's everything from the nausea to the vomiting and the other less desirable things that come along with foodborne illness. It really takes 2 to 3 days to run its course in the body. It's really important that individuals remain hydrated, keep those electrolytes coming. Look at the BRAT diet, the bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast to keep some nutrients in your body. And then under normal circumstances, 2 to 3 days, you're feeling back to yourself again. In very severe cases, dehydration is a really big concern. So if it hasn't really cured itself after 2 or 3 days, or it's getting worse within that course of 2 to 3 days, we encourage you to seek out medical help with a primary care physician or a clinician that can help you get back on the mend.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned it kind of runs its course after 2 to 3 days, so it doesn't require any kind of antibiotics or anything. It's like a cold.
Right. It is a virus, yeah, so you're going to kind of have to just grin and bear it, unfortunately. And generally, you know, we see families with it because when one person gets it a couple days before they start feeling ill, they are contagious. And so we just encourage everybody to wash your hands, especially this time of year for a variety of reasons, but norovirus being one. Hand sanitizer is proven to be minimally effective against norovirus. Hand washing with warm water for 30 seconds with good soap and water is always the best course of action to limit the spread of disease. Obviously, sanitizer is good in a number of other things with respiratory disease, but it shouldn't be relied upon as the sole source of protection against norovirus. So, as always, us public health advocates are gonna request that people wash their hands, wash them often, and then, of course, if you're not feeling well, whether it's in your stomach and that area or as a respiratory head cold, stay home until you're feeling better. Get that rest you need and then get back to it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of restaurants, as you mentioned, probably get bad rap, people saying that they were food poisoned, which may not necessarily be the case. So how would you know the difference? And, I mean, how would you treat that? Because you would be involved if it was a food poisoning case, no?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a number of factors. I will say that our food establishments here in Summit County do a really good job. Usually if it occurs inside of a restaurant, it's more than two people that are connected. That's the definition of an outbreak. So you and I went into a restaurant. We don't live together. I went in and ate at 7 o'clock and you ate at 7:30. If we both came down with the same thing, that might be an exposure inside of a restaurant. I don't know the exact numbers, but statistics tell us that the majority of foodborne illnesses are caused inside the home. With the latency period of that exposure and then when symptoms show up, it tends to be, well, we connected immediately to somebody else, something that where we ate. And that generally isn't the case, especially in today's social media world. Restaurants have another way of I guess, people evaluating them in addition to food inspection scores. And so while the health department's an important piece of that, so is the social media aspect. And they're going to do everything they can to protect themselves, protect their name, and, of course, protect their customers. So just be aware that we can expose ourselves just as much at home as we do anywhere else.
Sure. How long would it take, though, to experience the effects of food poisoning, if in fact that was what it was?
Yeah, so food poisoning, there's two types. There's a chemical exposure. That's where something that wasn't meant to be in the food ended up in there, like a cleaning agent. And those symptoms are immediate because that chemical makes its way into the body. The body responds as needed or as appropriate, and we start to feel sick or ill immediately. When it's biological, so like a norovirus or salmonella, the virus, the bacteria that we ingest needs time to replicate inside of our body. So that can be anywhere from 12 to 48 hours before we start to really feel sick. That's the reason it's important that we have two or more, that are not connected, because your exposure might be considerably greater than mine was. And so the time for it to replicate inside your body and cause illness would be shorter than someone that wasn't or didn't ingest as many viruses or bacteria. So tracking down foodborne illnesses and outbreaks can be really tough, just given some of those various factors.
Okay. As we can see outside the KPCW windows here, Sundance is just around the corner as they start to build the Accuro Plaza here in the Bob Wells Plaza. How is the health department involved in Sundance? I know this is a lot of work for you guys.
It is. Our environmental health team works very closely with the vendors, very closely with our partners at Park City Municipal and the building department. And just as we talked about with norovirus, the role of environmental health is twofold. First is there's mass gathering permits. We want to make sure that the event is clean, it's sanitary, that the trash is handled, that there's water available, that really when people come to Park City, they have a pleasant experience for a variety of reasons. But we really don't want there to be any type of foodborne illness outbreak associated with Sundance. Just like in the days of the pandemic, we worked with Sundance closely to implement protocols and procedures to limit exposure to the to COVID. We're also doing that in today's world, post-pandemic, trying to make sure that the food vendors and our establishments are following the FDA food code, that they're doing what they can to limit the spread of disease, make sure that we're going through the wash, rinse, sanitize protocols for the dishes that are used. And because of the efforts of our environmental health team and our partnership with Park City, I don't want to say that it's effortless, but it's a lot smoother than it used to be. Our partners at Park City recognize the value of the health department and have invited us into the fold. We're part of the early planning process. And as a result of that, our team and our administrative assistants have really streamlined the application process to make it easier for businesses, whether it's a local business or an out-of-state business, to come in, provide the documentation that's necessary for our inspectors to be out on Friday night. That kicks off on Thursday, and Friday night, a team of eight in pairs go out and bang out all those inspections over the course of the evening, making sure that the rest of the weekend is safe, it's sanitary, and it's people can have a good time. And then throughout the rest of the weekend, we have people on call working with the emergency management at Park City that if something goes awry, they can get a hold of an environmental health scientist extremely quick, and we can be on the scene responding as needed.
Okay, it seems like since COVID, the number of businesses here doing these kind of special events has dropped off. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, absolutely. The days pre-COVID or pre-pandemic were a lot more, they were a lot busier. On the backside of that, we've seen that number dwindle. I think a lot of it has to do with not only the pandemic, but back before COVID, we had a lot of vendors coming from out of state. They would rent out space on Main Street. Our local vendors might take a break or a hiatus and come back after the event, and we haven't seen that anymore. We're actually really excited to see our local vendors own their space, take advantage of this opportunity, and then if they see an opportunity to do something outside of the norm and they want to bring that to the Sundance Film Festival, they call our group. We work with them to get them inside of the regulations and compliant, and then allow them to, you know, take advantage of Sundance and the extra economic opportunity that it presents. And for a couple weeks, manage and get by, and then when Sundance leaves, get back to normal and finish out the ski season strong.
All right. January, National Radon Awareness Month. This is the time that you encourage people to actually do some radon testing because our doors and windows are closed. Do you have those kits available?
We do, absolutely. Yeah, we sell the radon kits year-round for $15 there at the health department. And we do encourage people in January, with it being National Radon Awareness Month, to test, but we also encourage individuals to test with as the seasons change, right? Because there's differences in our soil and in our environment. There's a lot of building still going on, and anytime you're disturbing the soil or the earth, it can change the path of that naturally occurring uranium in the soil and put the radon on the path of least resistance, which tends to find its way into our basements, into those areas of our basement that are less occupied. And it is the number two cause of lung cancer in the United States, and the number one cause of lung cancer among non-smokers. Of course, the number one cause of lung cancer is tobacco use, but it is it is one of those public health concerns or topics that is easily mitigated. There is a financial cost to that, but in the event that you test and your numbers are high, we have professionals at the health department that can help walk you through that process of understanding your situation and how you can mitigate that. And if you've tested once back a couple of years ago, maybe it's time to test again. We don't, like I said, we don't want to necessarily believe that it's a one and done sort of thing, but with the tests being as cheap as they are and some of the severe consequences that are associated with radon, we encourage individuals to test. And then on our website, we have a radon heat map, which shows the tests throughout the year as they come in, and it creates that traditional heat map that we're all used to seeing, showing where we've seen homes test that have high numbers of radon. The unique thing about our map is it's not just the hot spots, but it also shows where individuals have tested and the numbers are below action levels. So it's a great resource. People can find that at summitcountyhealth.org and type in radon in the upper right-hand corner, and it will take you to the radon page with the map. We just redid our website, which makes it a lot easier to search now. We had some struggles with that earlier in the year, so we appreciate your patience. But if you use that map and you can zoom in as close as the street level, find out where you're at and see what it looks like around your area, it gives you a sense of whether you should be testing or not. And then furthermore, if you don't see any test results in your area, it's a great time to get one of those tests, talk with our staff on how to use it, and then get that in your home and see what you're dealing with.
Okay. Also, just we should note that the Board of Health has a new board member. That's actually Council Liaison Megan McKenna. So does she actually vote as part of the Board of Health?
Yeah, absolutely. We're sad to see Tanya go, but as she assumes her chair responsibilities with the council, we expected that she would take a leave from the Board of Health. We had the opportunity to work with her for 2 years as she continued to not only advocate for the council strategic initiatives, but also our east side. And now we have the opportunity to work with Megan as she comes on as a new board member. Megan and I, we go way back. We have a history when she was in the world of the teaching there at Parks in Park City School District. We worked closely during COVID. And now we have an opportunity to bring her passion for the environment and passion for those public health initiatives that we worked on during COVID to the Board of Health. I know Megan is well known for her work around housing and housing advocacy, but in my meeting with Megan, I found her to be a very kind person and very passionate about the environment, sustainability, climate change, those things that the health department has taken on here in the last few years. And I think with her experience there and then her passion and excitement to be a new council member, we're very fortunate to have her supporting our efforts there at the Summit County Health Department.
Yeah, why is it important, though, to have a council member on the board?
Well, as I said, public health people are passionate, and I think it creates a checks and balances for us, making sure that we're aligned with what the council sees as the vision for the county. But also it provides an opportunity for us as the Board of Health to share with the council what it is we find important. We've had Roger on the Board of Health and then, as we mentioned, Tanya for a couple of years and now Megan. So out of the five council members, three of them have exposure to public health. And I think as I've been very open about in the past, we have a very good situation here with public health. We have a council that understands what we do as the Board of Health. They're supportive of public health, behavioral health, sustainability, those things that are contained inside the health department. And with the Board of Health, a council, and then a board, public health department that's aligned, it really is the perfect trifecta, and we're very fortunate to have a council that supports us.
Okay, Phil, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I appreciate the time.
Okay, Phil Bondurant is the director of the Summit County Health Department. In the studio now with an update from Youth Sports Alliance, I have Executive Director Emily Fisher along with Programs Director Heather Sims. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Emily, I know you want to say something about Lauren Masuga's first World Cup win.
Oh, we are so excited. Lauren Masuga won her first World Cup yesterday in St. Moritz. just so exciting. She is a get out and play and Park City Ski and Snowboard alumni. She participated on our Alpine Learn to Ski program. So also did some Learn to Ski Jump programs. Just so exciting to see her at the top of the podium yesterday. Truly a local kid through and through. So very exciting.
Okay. And she's not the first one though, right?
No, not the first one. And we've had lots of other local athletes that are sort of just getting into their season. I saw Ashley Farquharson's mom in the grocery store yesterday, and she said that Ashley was sixth in a World Cup yesterday, so very exciting. And the team won a bronze, so that was exciting. Casey Dawson is back on the ice later this month in Calgary. He's had a great start to his season. Last week, Jessica Duda, who was eighth in moguls, Nate Gendron was made it to quarterfinals in duels. And Chase Littlefield was 10th in moguls. So Freddie Mickle and Jack Patrone, all from Wasatch Freestyle, competed at the moguls and the Junior World Championship. There was also U.S. Aerials Championships. There was three local athletes swept the podium, Winter Vanecki, Karina Elliott, and Tasia Tanner. So just exciting to see all the local athletes, you know, now that we've been around for a while. These Heather and I remember when they were just young and up-and-comers. We're helping zip their jackets, put their mittens on, and to see them on the world stage is super exciting.
Yeah, how long has that Get Out and Play been around?
So it started really as a PTO program, and the Youth Sports Alliance took it over in 2010. So, we've been around for a while now. I can't believe it's 2025. But to see those athletes just make it onto the world stage is so exciting. And just to think we have so many athletes out and about right now to that, you know, someday they could be on that world stage.
Yeah. All right. But let's just jump right into the after-school programs then, Heather, because, again, this is where a lot of these folks that we're hearing about now with great results kind of got their starts.
Yeah, I mean, we currently this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Monday, we have 850 kids out and about on the Wasatch Back. We're doing, you know, skiing, ski jumping, freestyle, ice skating, Woodward, so a bunch of programs, and not just the snow and ice programs. We're also doing programs in Heber, which include cooking with Summit County Eats and Fit Stop and the Golf Lodge. So out of those 850, they make up almost 2,000 registrations that we've had this year. And 240 of those are on full or partial scholarships, which is 28% of our kids. 115 families received sibling discounts and first responders or school employee discounts, thanks to the financial support from Kodiak. Which is keeping our programs affordable. In addition to Kodiak, both Park City Mountain through Epic Promise Share Winter and Park City Community Foundation help underwrite our programs. But this week we actually did our Gear Up Night for our scholarship kids, and that is where we do two nights of literally gearing up kids from head to toe, and it is truly a community effort. We can't do it without the help of the local shops in town. Switchback Sports provide 100 sets of our equipment. They maintain those for us. And then we use local shops like Cole Sports, Jan's, Aloha, and Utah Ski and Golf to literally outfit 143 kids from top to bottom. We ourselves look for clothing over the years to make sure that kids don't turn up in sweatshirts, which has happened in the past when they've really not had anything, or their mittens have been those, you know, kind of cotton ones. And so we collect used clothing throughout the year and wash them and make sure that every kid has everything that they need before they head back to the mountain.
Okay, so it's not Cole Sport and Jan's giving you the clothing. It's actually you're using it kind of season to season?
So, no, the kids keep the clothing. Cole Sports and Jan's provide the actual ski equipment and snowboard equipment. So they take that out of their inventory for the 5 weeks of the programs. So, and then any kids that need clothing come to us and at Switchback Sports.
And we've had a lot of great support from local donors who've donated to our equipment fund so we can purchase helmets or goggles or mittens or gloves when we need to. So we really run low on quality snow pants, sort of in those 8, 10, 12 sizings. So we write grants for those items. We have some really strong donors. So it's great to be able to have a family or a kid who come in and they really have nothing to be appropriately dressed and to be able to see them leave with helmets and goggles and buffs. We have, you know, turtle fur donates tons of buffs. We have all different kinds of things that people contributes to make sure that those kids are not just have the hard goods, but also are comfortable and warm so they can participate and have a great time.
Okay, so they return the actual skis or snowboard, keep the clothing.
Yes, that works. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And honestly, you know, the kids are so excited. It's one of my favorite nights of the year. Those kids will see me in the grocery store in the summer and be like, when's skiing happening? So, you know, having a 400 kids on Friday out at both resorts, Canyons and Park City, and seeing them all kitted out and smiley faces and ready to go, it was great.
And I love that Heather and her staff organize all of this so the athletes are and students are geared up before the program actually starts. So on Friday when they show up at school and they get on the bus, nobody's really sure, you know, who needed maybe a helmet or a pair of gloves or snow pants or the whole kit. So everybody, when they get to school, nobody knows who's a scholarship athlete or student and who is not. And so they're all just getting on the same bus together, having the same experience, talking about wipeouts and having a great time out on all of our community resources.
Okay, so of those 850 that you've got in programs this week, could you do more if you had more room?
We actually could. Honestly, the limiting effect for us is the equipment. And because we utilize all the shops that are willing to help us right now, if we were able to get, you know, 20 more sets from another store or whatever, we would definitely be able to add more low-income students to the program. And that's something that we are always looking at, you know, building those relationships with local stores. Those stores are pulling from their inventory for 5 weeks. So a lot of those, they'll say, I can do 10 sets or 16 sets. And so that's the amount they can loan us for that time.
Sure. Let's talk just a little bit about the programs itself. You've got mostly sold out, it sounds like.
Yeah, so we have a few new programs still coming up in February. We have cross-country skiing, freestyle at UOP, Nordic jumping at UOP, Woodward freestyle for North Summit. And then we also have an introductory and progression for skiing at Woodward for North Summit and Wasatch. And if anybody is interested in looking at those, our programs are Get Out and Play, which is our 1st through 5th program, and Activate, which is our 6th through 12th. And they can go and look at those programs on ysausa.org.
All right, so program fees range from nothing to how much?
So we very rarely do nothing, unless there is special circumstances. But most of our programs start with a scholarship of $15 for something like the cooking class. But most programs with transportation, the scholarship's $50. And our most expensive is our ski program, which is if you don't have a pass, it's $235. And if you do, it's $210, which is still amazing deal for 5 afternoons on the hill, instruction, lift pass, everything.
Okay. You still looking for volunteers?
Always. we truly can't run our programs without volunteers, from people helping kids gear up, parents gearing up at the schools, to riding the bus as a chaperone. Really, that's the way we keep our programs affordable. If we had to pay people to do those to volunteer to run those programs with us, we would not be able to keep them affordable. And we utilize about 100 volunteers just in those 4 days from Thursday to Monday.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I just wanted to say thank you to all those volunteers. Special shout out to Stephen Nyman. He is a board member of ours. He was on the bus this week with his daughter for the Get Out and Play cross country program. And like I said, he's a board member, chaperone, and volunteer, not to mention a four-time Olympian. So you do not have to be a four-time Olympian to be a volunteer, but we just really appreciate those volunteers. We couldn't do it without them. And to fill out an application, you just go to ysausa.org.
Okay, Emily Fisher, Heather Sims, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, two Park City High School students helped develop interactive history games for middle and high schoolers. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the games not only teach kids about history, but how to think for themselves.
The unusual task came to Park City High School students Taylor Bergman and Garrett Moreno through the Park City Centers for Advanced Professional Studies, or PCCAPS, program. Bergman and Moreno were selected to help Victoria Sanders and her Wyoming-based company, Elephanta Education, by developing and testing history games for middle and high school classrooms. Sanders began researching and developing her interactive series Brave in 2018. The four-game series simulates historical events by allowing students to role-play buying and selling commodities, model trade dynamics, and explore key events from U.S. history. Bergman and Moreno joined Sanders as she was developing her second series, Parlor Games, which explores the U.S. imperialist era of the late 19th century. Moreno, a senior, said the games are meant to replace traditional textbooks and lesson plans and engage kids without using screens.
With a game where you get instant feedback and like a greater perspective because you're taking the position of someone within history, you gain a lot more knowledge and a lot more understanding that way.
Sanders said the Brave and Parlor games were developed to meet national and many state learning standards. Bergman said the first thing she and Moreno did was test the first of the second series games. Called Reach, it follows Alaska's transformation from U.S. territory to 51st state, exploring the different perspectives and beliefs held during that time. The students then started work on the next two games in the series. One challenge for Bergman and Moreno was making the games work for an older audience. This next set of games touches on themes older kids struggle with, including being authentic, empathetic, and honest. They also added more complexity and strategic decision-making. Each parlor game is meant to be played with a world map and a group of 5 to 6 students in 5 one-hour sessions. While the collaboration between Bergman, Moreno, and Sanders has ended, Sanders said her work isn't done yet. She's continuing to develop the parlor series, which will eventually have 5 games. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And in the studio now with an update from Park City Education Foundation, I have President and CEO Ingrid Whitley along with Vice President of Advancement, Jen Bello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Ingrid, let's start with you. Maybe just get a brief overview of what the Education Foundation is and what it is you do.
Yeah, of course. Park City Education Foundation is Park City School District's closest community partner. We fund and support educator-powered initiatives that support all the educators and students in our district through a variety of initiatives we support, including preschool, which we'd love to share more about today.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that. That's one of what, how many programs you run?
We support 8 initiatives, lots more programs, I think, than 8, probably closer to 100, but through those 8 initiatives, our funding goes far.
Okay, well, let's get an update then on the preschool program, because what we know is that we spent a bunch of money to build out preschool space, at least 2 of the 4, with, I think, the other 2 coming online this next school year.
Yes, that's right. So the new preschool spaces at Jeremy Ranch and McPolin opened the beginning of this school year. Beautiful new spaces, really specially designed to serve the 3- and 4-year-olds in the preschool program. And that allows for an expansion of the program. So this year, 3-year-olds for half day. Next year, registration's open right now. And if you're a parent in Park City School District, you can enroll your 3-year-old or your 4-year-old for full day or half day. Next year, this is the only program in the entire state that offers full day preschool, which is something to really celebrate in our community. And that was made possible by this expansion that voters approved.
So how does that work? I mean, kids are there how long?
So I think the day starts at 8:30.
Yeah, so the day starts at 10 after 8. It follows the same as the elementary programs and then goes till 3:10, I believe, or 3:05. So it follows exactly the elementary program. And then there, what's also exciting, this was the first year for four-year-olds, and next year for three-year-olds after school will be offered. So basically you can drop your child off a little before eight, and then they can go all day until six. So for working families, this is a huge, huge piece of that child care preschool puzzle, that you can have your child in safe, affordable, and high quality preschool. So it's not just daycare, you know, you're getting the curriculum as well, but it includes lots and lots of play and naps and food and the library and all the fun things that happen at elementary school. But for the first time, it can be all day. For three-year-olds, there was only a 2 day a week, 2 hours a day option before. And if were a working family, that wasn't a great option, because how can, you know, you go leave work and then bring your kid after 2 hours? So the school district had sent out a survey, you know, once the bond was passed and the first buildings got up, to see what the appetite was for this. And 86% of the survey respondents said, yes, we need all day preschool for our 3 and 4 year olds. Mm-hmm. So it's fantastic. And what's also great is with this expansion, there'll be seats for up to 288 children. Before, there was only room for, I think, 164. Mm-hmm. And so that almost doubles it. And the other exciting thing is it is tuition based. The tuition is very reasonable, but there are scholarship tuition available as well that gets it down to about $125 a month for preschool, and then the after school is an additional charge. The head of the preschool department, Dan Gallery, he told us that equals 79 cents an hour for scholarship students. That's remarkable. And so I think the school district is incredibly proud to offer this based on the needs and desires of its patrons, and we're incredibly proud to help support it.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Somebody's paying for it, and taxpayers are.
Yes. So taxpayers agreed. Now the thing about preschool is it is tuition based. The scholarships are coming from the Department of Workforce Services. So it isn't just the local taxpayers that are shouldering that. You know, the whole state pitches in, because preschool, early child care, is such a huge issue. And most of Utah is a child care desert, and Park City is included in that.
Yeah. So with we know with the Jeremy Ranch and McPullen, they have what is called that wraparound, right? So that you can offer that before and after school program. What about the other two schools, Trailside and Parley's? Are they also going to have that opportunity?
Yes, all schools will. So no matter where you live in the district, if your child's enrolled in preschool, they'll have the same available options to them in every preschool.
Okay, and then that 288, that's district-wide?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned the cost. I do want to, you know, shout out our supporters. So our donors and then therefore us contribute $125,000 to support the preschool program annually. And that's really made possible by Park City Mountain, supported by Vail Resorts Epic Promise. They've been a longtime partner and supporter of the preschool program since 2014. And then Westgate Foundation is also a huge supporter of preschool. And economically, this is an amazing investment. Every dollar that we put in to support preschool as a community results in a $13 return. So, you know, there is obviously a community-wide engagement in making this possible, but the results on the back end are really cost savings for our entire community.
Well, explain that. For every dollar invested, you get $13 in a return.
So yeah, we're addressing an opportunity or an education gap early on. So, you know, a lot of research shows the earlier you get students in school results in lower learning loss. It, you know, closes those gaps from lower socioeconomic families earlier on. So you're not dealing with the ramifications in high school or then college, right? So you're more kids are graduating high school, more kids are going to college, lifetime earnings are greater. I don't know all of the research, but a lot of it points to preschool being a really wonderful investment in our community.
What happens if kids don't go to preschool ahead of time and they're not kindergarten ready is then you have to invest a lot of extra resources in that K through three, because we all know if you're not reading by third grade, you're behind kind of the rest of your life. So when school districts and the taxpayers have to pay for extra special ed needs, extra aides, all those extra personnel to do that kind of intensive rehab learning, you avoid a lot of that if kids come to school kindergarten ready.
So does preschool also offer the dual immersion that each of the schools do?
No.
That doesn't
start someday maybe, but no.
Yeah, not right now.
Not right now.
Kindergarten is when that starts.
I actually think it might start in first grade.
Yeah.
Other than maybe McPolin, because that's a fully dual school. But I believe first grade is when dual immersion starts.
Okay. So you've got registration going on. That's for next school year?
Or? Yes. Yep. Open January 6th. I think it closes February 7th. And then enrollment for after school will begin in April. So parents who are looking for that after school option, just know that that's not quite open yet, but it will be available next year.
And we really encourage everyone to register as soon as possible. What you're actually registering for is to be put into a lottery, because there always had to be a lottery in the past. They're still doing it that way. They're not expecting to have to use a lottery, but just in case they didn't want to have to go back later and go, oh, we're putting everybody's name into the hat. But what that helps them do as well is figure out, how many people want full day? How many people want half day? It might be that there's only half day at one school because there isn't as much of a need or as much as a desire. So the lottery goes, I believe, until February to register February 7th. And then the actual registration process will start after that.
Okay. So again, I mean, if somebody was paying full bore here, what would they pay each month for preschool?
So it's $810 a month for tuition for full paying families. And then again, the sliding scale options, $125 a month for families who qualify. And I would encourage also families who qualify to look at the DWS subsidies. The city has a wonderful scholarship. Summit County has a scholarship. So a lot of options for families who need that extra support.
Okay, and then to have the after school available, again, that's another $125 a month?
That, I will have to get back to you on that. It is, it won't be $125 for scholarship students, but I can't remember off the top of my head what that is. But it is less than that.
Okay, so I mean, you're into it. If you need a kid care for a work day, I mean, you're talking about $1,000 a month per kid.
But if you compare that to what you're paying at all the private preschools, it is a lot less.
Okay. And is that what you do then, tend to take then, those people that need it most, so that people that can afford it are going to the small businesses?
So that this year, again, I think the expectation is that there won't have to be a lottery. They do tend to take first students that are siblings, I think is their first. Second are the students of our teachers. Third are students who are on the free and reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. And then fourth is everybody else.
Yes.
But again, the hope is that there won't be a need for that this year.
Okay, you got some events coming up. Want to tell us about those?
Yes, we're really excited. So coming up on February 6th, we are partnering with the Summit County Health Department to show Screenagers, which is a film about, as you can guess, teenagers and phones. It came to the community a few years ago, and we wanted to bring it back. And there will be a panel discussion after with several of our counselors. Ingrid will be moderating that panel. It's free and open to the whole community at the Eccles Center on February 6th at 5 p.m., and early bird registration for Running With Ed opens March 1st. And then internally, all the art teachers and art departments, they're running a holiday card contest for PCEF. So we've never had a holiday card before. We'd love to start doing that, and we'll do that for holiday 2025. And so right now there's a contest going on throughout the district, and kids can talk to their art teachers about that, and we'll have different winners in different age group categories. But it's going to be super fun. We're really excited to see the art.
Okay, and they've got till February 14th actually to submit.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.